Doc by trade and practiced in the public health service for a couple of years in Appalachia, and then north of Boston. I was a family doctor for 20 years. And became aware that the articles that had been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about Celebrex and the New England Journal of Medicine about Vioxx that convinced us doctors that we should prescribe these COX-2 medicines for our patients who need anti-inflammatory medications, became aware that these articles in our most trusted journals had misled us. And in terms of funding Senator Sanders' bill, we've spent $25 or $30 billion on COX-2 drugs where we could have spent about a tenth or a twentieth as much on generic anti-inflammatory drugs, and people would have been better off with the anti-inflammatory drug. So if we ante up the money initially, we're going to get it back many times over in the future. Now, you've heard the good news. I'm going to tell you the bad news, because there's really serious problems. What's happened over the last 30 years, with medical knowledge, not with medical system, not with healthcare system delivery, not even with drug markups, but with health, with medical knowledge itself, has paralleled what's gone on in the banking industry. So as the banking industry became deregulated and started to construct these very risky financial instruments that led to the crisis of 2007-2008, we all got a lesson in how unregulated markets can fail to serve the public interest. We've had exactly the same thing happen to medical knowledge. Over the last 30 or 40 years, we've privatized the development, the generation, the creation of medical knowledge, and the dissemination of medical knowledge. So when we talk about struggling to pay for drugs, yes, I would write a prescription for Dr. Sanders if he came to me as a family doctor. The problem is I would not have access to the true information about the drug that the drug companies have. And in theory, this sounds like an overstatement, but let me show you how serious this problem is. First, I do have conflicts of interest. I serve as an expert to plaintiff's attorneys in litigation involving the pharmaceutical industry, and I'm a consultant to Wells Fargo to try to help self-insured companies buy pharmaceuticals more rationally. So I want to share with you the truth about Vioxx, and I don't think anybody in this room knows what I'm going to say. Because Vioxx, like many issues in healthcare knowledge, when you think you've gotten to the bottom, when you think you've finally gotten to the bottom, there's a new bottom to be had. And this information just came out in litigation last year that I was involved in. This is the article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November 2000 that contributed to 20 million Americans taking Vioxx. 20 million Americans. And as you can see, the title of the article is Comparison of Upper Gastrointestinal Toxicity of Rofecoxib, which is Vioxx, and Naproxen, which is Aleve, in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Now, the reason why this study was done is because when Vioxx was approved, it was approved with the standard GI warning on the label that goes with all anti-inflammatory drugs. And the only reason for a doctor to prescribe Vioxx for his or her patients was the claim that it was safer on the GI tract, that it caused fewer GI complications. We had learned through a large public relations effort that 16,500 people died every year from the GI complications of anti-inflammatory medicines. And the purported advantage was that Vioxx would cause fewer serious GI symptoms. They wanted the warning lifted so they could really sell the hell out of it. Now, we've got a problem, because they're trying to get the warning lifted for GI symptoms, but we're doing this study to get the warning lifted on people with rheumatoid arthritis. And we've got an external validity problem, because 56% of the people in this study were taking steroids concurrently with an anti-inflammatory medicine. And in the real world, somewhere between 3 and 5% of people take steroids concurrently. So they selected a population that was far more likely to have GI trouble. The conclusion was, in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, treatment with Vioxx, a selective COX-2 inhibitor, is associated with significantly fewer clinically important upper GI events than treatment with naproxen, a non-selective inhibitor, and there's 16 events in the Vioxx group and 37 events in the naproxen group, and that's the basis upon which we prescribed Vioxx for 20 million people. Now, there are a couple problems with this article. One is that there was more cardiovascular harm than there was GI benefit. There were 45 cardiovascular events in the people, serious blood clots, heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes. There were 45 in the people who took Vioxx and 19 in the people who took naproxen. So where there's a 21-person advantage here, there's a 27-person disadvantage. But that was not included in the article. They only included heart attacks. Why did they only include heart attacks? Because there were fewer heart attacks, and even though the relative risk was greater, it didn't hit statistical significance. Why didn't it hit statistical significance? Because Merck withheld three heart attacks that occurred in the Vioxx group. And the New England Journal of Medicine editors issued an expression of concern in December 2005 because one of the editors had been deposed and there was concern that the deposition was going to hit the news media. So 5 years after the fact, the New England Journal of Medicine issued an expression of concern saying it didn't include three heart attacks, and that would have shown that Vioxx increased the risk of heart attacks for all patients, whether or not they had a previous history of heart disease. All patients.
The floppy disk story part of this.
I can go on for 20 hours, so I can't go there. So this is what we're left with. So we've got a drug, drug that's being sold somewhere. $10 billion worth of drug is sold, and it's a more dangerous drug than the generic alternative that costs a tenth to a twentieth as much. And there were 47,000 lawsuits that were settled for $4.85 billion with people who had heart attacks and strokes. 47,000. Now, let me show you. That doesn't work. This is a chart. There's what's called a clinical study report. When a drug company does a trial, the point I want to make here is that drug companies do virtually all of the research on their drugs pre-approval and phase four. It's virtually all done by the drug companies, and they own the data. And they don't necessarily share the data in a responsible way. And that's what I'm going to show you here, is how irresponsible Merck was in misrepresenting the benefit of Vioxx. This is a chart. So when a drug company does a clinical trial, it creates about a 3,000-page clinical study report that it sends to the FDA. That study report is not available but on a Freedom of Information Act request. It's confidential. It's proprietary information. Now, Al Capone, you know Al Capone the gangster? Al Capone had a saying, you get more with a smile and a gun than you get with a smile alone. And when you want to know the truth about a drug, you get more with a smile and a subpoena than you get with a smile alone. And this is the kind of issue that comes out in litigation, but too often remains unsealed. This I presented in court, so it is unsealed and I can share it with you. So this is a chart from Merck's clinical study report that was included in the FDA review of Vioxx about the GI hearing, about the GI warning. And this is confirmed PUBs. This means PUBs is perforations, ulcers, and bleeds. Now, I apologize, it's going to get a little bit geeky, but stay with me because you're going to see how misled physicians were, the best physicians were, about this drug. So this is confirmed perforations, ulcers, and bleeds, and that means a combination in a ratio of about 3-to-1 of serious GI problems that require hospitalization or transfusion and are potentially life-threatening, 1-to-3 stomach complaints that because the patient was in a clinical study, the patient got endoscoped and they found an ulcer, and called it an ulcer, even though there's no proof that the fact that there was an ulcer there is correlated to the symptoms or that it was going to be a serious problem. And when you look at the people who were taking steroids and the people who were not taking steroids, you see that the reduction in perforations, ulcers, and bleeds was statistically significant amongst the people taking steroids, not statistically significant because the confidence interval crosses one in people who weren't taking steroids. But when you compare both groups, there's not a statistically significant heterogeneity between the two groups, and Merck could legitimately say that Vioxx decreased the risk of perforations, ulcers, and bleeds in people who were or were not taking steroids. Now, in the litigation, we noticed that they didn't report the data on whether steroid use or non-steroid use affected the serious GI complications, and that's what we clinicians cared about. So we constructed this table from data that we got, primary data that we got that is only available through subpoena. And what we found is we're now looking not at all the perforations, ulcers, and bleeds, but the one in the 1-to-3 ratio, we're looking at the one part that's serious GI complications. This is serious stuff. And we go no baseline steroid use and baseline steroid use. And we see the 9 and the 7 is 16 versus the 37 that we saw on the first slide. Now look at this. If we look at the no baseline steroid use, which is what the condition of about 95% of the people who get prescribed Vioxx, there's absolutely no reduction in serious GI complications. It was a ruse. It was a ruse. The $10 billion we spent, the people who got hurt with the heart attacks and strokes, were for naught. Vioxx does not work better than anti-inflammatory drugs, and when Merck pays for the patients to take the bus into the FDA advisory committee to say how that Vioxx is the only drug that ever helped them, in double-blind studies, Vioxx is no better than naproxen. So for every patient that did better on Vioxx, there's a patient who did better on Aleve. It's no better. Here's the problem. This is an article. David Graham, the hero from the FDA, is the lead author of this article. It was published in Lancet. It says, an estimated 88 to 140,000 excess cases of serious coronary heart disease probably occurred in the USA over the market life of Vioxx because of Vioxx. The US national estimate of the case fatality rate, fatal acute MI plus sudden cardiac death, was 44%, which suggests that many of the excess cases attributable to Vioxx use were fatal. If you do the arithmetic, you calculate an approximate number of deaths from Vioxx at 50,000 Americans. That's almost as many Americans as died in the Vietnam War. Now, we doctors had no way of knowing that there was not a significant reduction in serious GI complications. The data was not in the New England Journal of Medicine article. The New England Journal of Medicine editors didn't have it, and the missing disc didn't have it. The peer reviewers didn't have it. The FDA didn't know they didn't have it. This data was not included in the clinical study report. And if you want to look online, I put in the case of Neurontin, where doctors were lied to. The Cochrane Review was lied to. I put in a case of Ketek where the FDA and physicians were lied to. We've got a situation where medical knowledge has become a private good. It's paid for by industry. It's communicated by industry. Industry does not have the burden of transparency. It is normative not to be transparent with clinical data. And this is the situation that we doctors are practicing in, where we're basically looking at the shadow on the cave, on the shadow on the cave wall, and not at the real data. And we cannot go forward. This is absurd. We cannot go forward without knowing what the research shows. And doctors do not understand. I would say 100% of doctors say that they get it, that the drug company biases the knowledge that they have in favor of their drugs. And I would say about 98% of physicians say, I know they bias it, but I can sort it out. But you cannot sort out what you cannot see. It just doesn't work. So any plan going forward, any plan, it's a public health emergency that we do not have transparency in clinical research. And that would be my plea, is that we must have transparency so physicians can know the truth about the drugs they prescribe. Thank you. And now, questions, please, for all of us speakers. Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to repeat it because this is being recorded. What are the kinds of questions that patients can ask their doctors to try and get better information? And the answer is that patients are not going to get better information from their doctors because their doctors don't have it. The ways that doctors receive information from medical journals, from guidelines, from continuing medical education, from thought leaders, and from their doctor's lounge have all been so infiltrated by industry that literally all of the information that the doctors have is coming from the drug industry. A British Medical Journal article showed that 97% of the most frequently cited articles, meaning the most influential articles, are commercially sponsored. So the doctors, the patients are going to have the information before the doctors. So I'd like to rephrase your question and say, as a patient who wants to be optimally informed, what can I do to bring the information to my doctor, not to get the information from my doctor? Now, step one, I believe, I've been doing this for a long time, and step one, I believe, is the FDA-approved label. The label says what the indications are, and about three-quarters of the off-label prescriptions don't have a scientific basis. Don't be misled by the idea that prescribing off-label is some kind of art that doctors uniquely possess. They've been convinced by marketing to prescribe the drug. So look at the indications that have been approved, because if there's good science to support the drug's use for an indication, it is typically the drug company will bring a supplemental new drug application through the FDA and get the indication, just like Merck wanted to do with Vioxx. So, and they did get the indication. The FDA kind of blew it a little bit, but they did. So number one, the indication in the label. Number two, the clinical trials in the label. Because there have to be two positive trials, pivotal trials. Now look at those trials, because you're going to see, the news says, breakthrough, this drug treats asthma. This drug prevents heart attack. They don't say that you need to treat 50 high-risk men with a statin for 5 years to prevent one heart attack. They don't tell you that, primary prevention. But if you look at the studies in the label, you can calculate the number needed to treat for yourself. And when you communicate with a doctor, you've got to communicate in the language that the doctor has been trained to receive. So that's number one. Number two, Cochrane reviews are very important. But Cochrane reviews do not have unpublished data in them. And it's even more dangerous when they do have unpublished data, because that means that the drug company has selectively turned over some of their unpublished data, but not all of it. So it's an even a worse sample than you had in the beginning. So Cochrane reviews are important. Cochrane reviews are important, but understand that it's only published data. Julie.
I just wanted to throw out the idea that there are federally sponsored studies that are making, that have made a major contribution. So we have the MTA study on the use of stimulants in children. We have the TIAS study, which I think is a terrific example. These are really independently designed post-marketing studies. So Lynn Sigich down in North Carolina led a study in which she compared a set of antipsychotic drugs in this, you know, we're now very eager to prevent schizophrenia by starting, you know, if a kid acts out a little bit in the 10 to 14 year old age group. But her study showed that the old first generation good old Molindone, which sadly is no longer on the market, so if somebody wants a drug development tip, I would say bring it back. But you know, all that good work we had selling us, the proprietary notion that second generation were better because they had relatively less EPSE. Okay. But anyway, to back to the point is that there are studies done in the public sector, and that now we have to educate physicians in forums that would allow us to debate. If we did some more debating or some more characterizing which is the population that is most likely to benefit, which is the population that are going to be, you know, sort of probably not unchanged, and who might really be harmed. So benefit risk is going to be something, I think, for the future. It's next where we have to go in terms of research that would be able to help an individual patient or parent make a decision around the preference, you know, for the drug or not.
Yep. And a couple other sources that I don't want to forget to mention is the Therapeutics Initiative out of British Columbia and the Drug Effectiveness Research Project out of Oregon. Those are also good sources. Yep.
John, would it help a patient, for patients to ask, doctor, is there a way of treating my problem without taking a drug? And then ask, is this the safest drug in its class?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Don. Many times if we talk about prevention of coronary artery disease, which is one of the biggest challenges for medicine. If we talk about the prevention, bye-bye, Howard. If we talk about the prevention of coronary artery disease, which is our biggest health burden, it's very clear that lifestyle modification is 3 to 5 times more effective than taking a statin for those people for whom a statin is effective. And doctors will very often say, but my patients won't do it. So if a patient says, I will do it, it's very important. Now, one place that docs misunderstand is that when a patient, say you have, you go to your doctor and your cholesterol is 230 and your doc says, you know, your cholesterol is a little high, I want to put you on a statin. And you say, well, wait a minute, I want to go adopt a healthier diet and start exercising routinely and then come back and see what happens. You come back and your cholesterol's still 230 and the doctor says, well, you failed, now I'm going to put you on a statin and you won't have to worry about it. The truth is that lifestyle doesn't lower cholesterol that much, but it sure does lower your risk of heart disease, and that's the goal. I'd like to sell t-shirts that say, he who dies or she who dies with the lowest cholesterol doesn't win. The goal is not to get a low cholesterol. The goal is not to have heart disease. So when you ask about lifestyle, make sure you're asking about the right endpoint. And it's not just lowering cholesterol, it's living a healthy lifestyle. Now, one other point is, I think also, Don, you should always ask your doctor if there's a generic drug available that will do the job for three reasons. Number one, it's been on the market for at least 7 years and we're unlikely to get a surprise. Number two, it's cheaper. much cheaper. In fact, generics are cheaper in the United States than they are in European countries. Our market works very well, and it shows that a market can work well. And number three is, if your doctor thinks you need a generic drug, it's not because a cute drug rep in a short skirt just brought the pizza. It's because at least for 7 years, there's been an ongoing belief that the drug is beneficial, and it's less likely to be a short-term blip in marketing. If you were charged, I agree. If you were charged with changing that, what steps would you take?
I think that doctors have to show some confidence in the drugs that they're prescribing. There's no confidence required of them in all of these prescriptions. They have a limitless license to write prescriptions for things they know nothing about.
Well, yeah. If we need medical school training, you've got to start really first year of medical school. And make a difference in the way that you
the way I see medical schools going, it is changing. Right. But there are all those guys out there that are prescribing things that the cute drug rep is writing. And all these doctors find ways around that. You know, you can say, well, the drug reps can't do that, and they're still doing, I don't know, something else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No pharmacists.
Ah, good.
We're not utilized.
Yes, that's correct.
But most of us aren't. And we're overtrained to count pills.
Right.
And so we're trying to push for requiring, what they call medication therapy management.
Right.
And we do look at the studies. There are so many outstanding clinical pharmacists that are not being utilized in that industry. And the other thing is generic meds are going up. There's something has happened recently. And the price of generic drugs, and a lot of them in California, this is an issue. Why are they, all of a sudden, going up substantially in price? So there's something going on there. The other thing is that it's impossible to get the senators, I want to get the bill because, I like to contact my senators from California and tell them they should be aware of it. And it's impossible to get the study, to get this information.
Sure. Probably given someone the number, but there's two bill numbers, S-1137 and S-1138. On our website, which is sanders.senate.gov, we've got summaries of the bill, we've got the bills, and there are other resources outside of our office that also track the idea of a prize model for reforming the system, with a lot of support from a number of prominent economists in the country. Who have support the idea of reforming the entire system along the lines of our bill. So.
There's Mr. Mayor has this other board for drug topics, which goes to 165,000 pharmacists. This would be a good idea.
Great. Yeah, great.
My vote is the chief counsel for the senator and the chief drafter. So if you'd like to ask questions of the man, he's here.
You've been wanting to ask a question, so please.
I have a comment I want to say, which is I'm a family physician. Everything that you said here reflects, I've been in practice for years and years, everything that you said reflects my practice. New drugs, we're inundated with new drugs, and over the course of the last 30 years, I can think of a few that shine.
Yep.
But so many that, that are touted as making improvements really haven't shown to have any benefit. But I want to just say something along the lines of what you said about lifestyle, which is another piece of it, and another piece of incentives is that physicians are also working under the long incentives. And the truth is, not only does lifestyle work, but the truth is people can change their lifestyle.
Yes.
But they're not going to change their lifestyle if doctors are doing what we're trained to do, which is prescribing a drug is much faster than, and much faster, much more rewarding. Everybody's much happier because somebody's making a profit than if we stop and take the time to talk
That's absolutely right. And I think when doctors say lifestyle counseling doesn't work, they're right. And when doctors say lifestyle and counseling does work, they're right. And the challenge is to get the doctors to realize that their mission, the reason why they get up in the morning and go to their office, is to try and make their patients healthier, and it involves working a little harder. There's no question. Don.
Something might be relevant to your work and also to the center's work, which perhaps you all know, and that is in Britain, medical students are trained only with a chemical name. Prescribing is only with a chemical name. All the literature is only with a chemical name. If you mention a trade name, you say what? They don't even know what they are. Okay? It is possible to have an entire healthcare system, medical training, residency training, and prescribing, and the pharmacy, all by the international chemical names. It's happening for 50 million people every week for years in England.
Don, I would argue the other side. Short of the senator's bill, I think we ought not to use the chemical name. This is just my feeling, but I think we ought not to use the chemical name for drugs that are available only as brand name drugs, because what we think we know about those drugs comes from the branding that the manufacturer has done. And I think it makes more sense to refer to Vioxx, because the drug that we know as Vioxx is the drug that Merck has taught us about. The day it becomes generic, then I would say no more, you can't use the brand name anymore. What the value of the drug is what the drug company has caused us to believe about it. That's the whole idea behind the prize, is that you can't have a PR company create the illusion of social benefit and collect the prize.
Come on, John. Hey, okay, go ahead.
I can't agree with you on that, John. If you use brand names, you have no idea what class the drug belongs to. If you're using generic names, you'll recognize that the class is the same. And if you know something about the class, you'll know something about the drug.
I think that's fair.
Also, you have to recognize the consumer who comes in, who has exalted expectations when you say, I have a new drug and it has no side effects. It's much better than the existing product. So how naive are any of us if we were to go for a car or a lipstick or some other damn thing, and somebody said, and this is absolutely better than any of the existing lipsticks that are out there, like what? None of us would believe those things. But when it comes to drugs and health and the promise of living forever, we are all very, very susceptible to the cell.
Okay, I back off, but I want to stick to the point that what we know about that drug comes from the manufacturer. And we've got to understand that.
In England, the marketing was for not Vioxx.
But the misrepresentation was from Merck.
Including the misrepresentation.
Yeah, right.
Was
right. Yeah.
We should quit.
Yeah. Thank you very much, folks.